From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Slavery was abolished in the U.S. nearly 150 years ago. And yet, no more than 5 hours from the busy streets of Manhattan, you can stand in broad daylight and buy a slave. Illegal trafficking in human beings is a problem we hear about in the news from time to time, where it can seem like an aberration. Something terrible, but far away. Well, it's not. In this hour, the human face of a hidden crime, slavery.
I grew up in a village, on a farm, in Michoacán. I grew up with my parents. And as a child, I was a very happy child. I remember feeling the love from my parents, my brothers and sisters, and just being spoiled when I was growing up.
Maria Suarez lives and works in Los Angeles. She's an attractive woman, dark-haired, professionally dressed. You could pass her on the street going to or from work or home and never think twice. But Maria spent 5 years of her life as a slave. This is her story.
I was going to be 16 when my father came to this country to get his green card, and I came with him. Not even a month, probably less than that, I was walking on the street, went to get my niece from school, and this woman approached me offering me a job. This job, she told me that it was a job that I was going to be cleaning and answering the phone. It was going to be a couple of elder people. I said, oh yeah, that will be good. Surprise my family with the job. So she says, okay, let's go and let's meet the person who you're going to be working for. And so I figure it's going to be just go and come back. The thing is that it was far away from one place to another, and it was longer than an hour. And by that time, I didn't speak English. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know my area where I was or anything. I just was new in this country. And we went to meet these people, and when I went, I met this man who it was like in his 68 or 70. The man appears to be okay, and I went in the house with them, and I noticed the windows and the doors had extra locks and extra padlocks, and even the phone, it was a rotary phone, had a lock. I start feeling my stomach like I'm in the wrong place, but I didn't pay attention to that. So then when they came out, I told them that I need to go home. I need to go to my house. And she says, between him and her, says, why don't you stay here and meet the wife? To make a long story short story, that they convinced me to stay there. And I said, the only way I can stay is if I tell my family that I'm going to be staying here. And he removed the lock from the phone, and I call my sister that I had found a job and I was going to stay there because I was going to be working. My sister didn't like that. She got a little upset, started asking me about address, phone number, where I was, and the name of these people. And I didn't even know the address, the phone number, not even the city or these people's name. I didn't even know anything. So I just keep asking that to the man, and the man keep wiggling his finger, telling me, I will take you home tomorrow. I will take you home tomorrow. Well, that tomorrow never came. I think I got a little bit of scared and at the same time angry or impatient. I don't know exactly what it was. And I said, well, you told me you were going to take me to my house. And he says that I was not going to go nowhere because he had paid $200 for me. I was his slave, and he was going to do to me whatever he wants to do. So by then, I can tell that he's angry, and he's like wanting to get hold of me, you know, like touch me or something. So I start running, and he catch me. When he catch me, he pulled me back and tore up all my clothes. And after he tore up all my clothes, he pushed me out of the house. And like a newborn baby out of the house, and it was cars passing by. And for somebody to do that to you, that's like, you know, you just want to have your clothes back or something. So I keep crying and crying and asking him, begging for my clothes. He was laughing through the window. The door had a window, laughing and looking at me. And he opened the door and he says, "You want your clothes?" And I said, "Yes, please let me have my clothes." So he says, "Okay, come and get it." So I go and get my clothes, and by, I don't know how he hit me. The thing is that I fell on and I hit my head on the top and I went unconscious. When I woke up, he had raped me. And he was standing by my feet, and I seeing myself that he had raped me. So I start crying, and he looked at me and he says that I better not tell no one because he's a witch and he can kill my family. He can burn my family's house and he can kill me. By then, I just felt like I were nothing. I couldn't tell my family. I couldn't do anything. How I was going to tell my family what these men have done to me. So I just kept quiet. Then the time kept running. You know, I lasted 5 years. During those 5 years, he abused me emotionally, physically, sexually. Those 5 years, I was living one day at a time, knowing that, okay, today I'm alive. Tomorrow I might be dead.
Maria's story went from bad to worse. The man who called himself her owner had an argument with a neighbor and killed him. He told the police Maria had committed the murder. With no English and no lawyer, Maria had very little hope of defending herself. She spent the next 23 years in prison for a crime she didn't commit. She was freed and her name cleared, in part through the efforts of a group called Free the Slaves. Today, Maria Suarez works with Free the Slaves, telling her story and doing what she can to help other victims of slavery, for whom she has this message.
It's never late. It's never late. It's always a chance to give people a sign that we need help. Either a word, a look, a little piece of paper, just to drop something, make people pay attention. You know, it's a lot of ways to let people know that, hey, I need help. That's my message. I want people to be aware that even though on the 1800s slavery we're supposed to have abolished, but it's not true. We still have that. And it's worse now, because now it's not only work. It's sexual and it's different in a lot of other ways. That's my mission. That's to help other victims.
For all that slavery was abolished 200 years ago, the terrible truth is that not only is slavery still flourishing, but there are, according to UN estimates, more slaves in the world today than at any other point in human history. Now, in a landmark piece of investigative reporting, journalist Benjamin Skinner has documented an international network of human traffickers and slave traders. In a book called A Crime So Monstrous, Skinner tells the story of how he infiltrated slave markets on five different continents, from slave quarries in India to child markets in Haiti. He told Anne Strangechamps about what he learned, beginning with the fact that if you're standing in the middle of Manhattan today, you're 5 hours away from negotiating the sale in broad daylight of another human being.
The distance that all of us are from modern-day slavery is actually even smaller than 5 hours. But in that instance, in the first chapter, I wanted to drive the point home by taking readers on a journey that I took myself, stepping on a plane at JFK International Airport and getting out at Port-au-Prince in Haiti. You go to one particular street, Delma 69, and there are four or five men who, when I was there, were standing in front of a barber shop. I pulled up in a car. One of them approached and said, "Do you want to get a person?" At this point, I began to negotiate with this individual for a human being, and I made it very explicitly clear from the beginning that I wanted this person to be a child, and I wanted this person to be mine for unpaid labor, for domestic work.
Isn't slavery illegal in Haiti?
Slavery is illegal human trafficking is not, as of
today.
What's
the difference?
Well, that's a very good question. In essence, it's as if slavery is illegal. The internal slave trade, as it were, is not illegal. And even the buying and selling, there's a fiction around. For example, the individual that I was negotiating with for this child, he said, I don't sell children, although it would seem that way. I place them. And he gets a fee for that placement.
How old are these children?
The maximum age, and this is the one legal restriction that has been brought in, although it is rarely enforced, is 15. In general, they're somewhere between age 7 and age 15. And the children that I was encountering were in the main under 10 years old. Mm. And these were children that were carrying water, they were cleaning chamber pots, they were doing laundry, they were cooking. And there's another aspect to this. When I was discussing a sale of what I made clear I wanted to be a 9-year-old girl, at one point, the gentleman who I name in the book leaned in and said, this is rather a delicate question, but would you want this child as a partner as well?
For sex.
For sex. And my immediate thought was, well, I'm glad you think so highly of me. And then my second thought was, If it's possible to have this child as a domestic slave, and this is what I said to him, as well as a partner, then I'd like that. And he said, no problem.
Wow. Did you go ahead and complete the sale?
I didn't. And this was, I should say, the first time where I actually had the ability to go through with the sale or to not go through with the sale. And it took a lot of soul searching. It took several nights of, frankly, sleepless nights about whether I would buy this child and then put her in an orphanage, obviously take care of her, or allow this child to be given over to fate. And frankly, there's no easy answer to it, but I looked at historical precedents. I looked at great journalists like Nick Kristof, a columnist at the Times, had been in a similar situation where he had purchased a young girl's freedom from a brothel and sent her back to her village with a small amount of money. When he returned 2 years later, he found that she was right back in the brothel, that she was then addicted to crystal meth and back in slavery. I thought that this is something that either I'm going to commit wholeheartedly to take care of this child, or I can't commit at all.
I suppose you never found out what child you might have bought or what happened to her.
I didn't. What I did is I went up into the highlands of southern Haiti to an extraordinarily remote village. And in this village, every single family had given away a child to a trafficker.
Did they know what would happen to their children?
They had a pretty good idea because certain children had returned and had told them of the abuse. It's not an easy decision to make for a parent. That's putting it lightly. Imagine you're watching your child slowly starve in front of you, and you have no prospect of putting food in front of them in a year. It's an easy thing to say, I shouldn't give my child over as a slave. It's a much harder thing to say, I should watch my child slowly starve in front of me. Freedom or death is a very nice slogan, but it doesn't work in all instances.
Is that what parents told you? And when you talked with them about why they'd given their children away?
They said, we have no other choice.
Did they appear to have suffered by making that decision themselves?
To say that they've suffered is definitely an understatement. I mean, to know, to have knowledge of the fact that you have given your child over to an extraordinarily abusive situation where that child may well have been raped is a level of guilt that I hope none of us have to feel.
I want to ask you about another trip you took, this one to Romania, a country that is part of the European Union, where you found that you could buy a girl for the price of a used car. How did you go about meeting a human trafficker there?
It's a bit like the old mafia movies where an FBI agent is going undercover. I never envisioned myself doing this kind of thing, but I talked to local journalists. They would put me in touch with somebody else, usually a low-level criminal, in this case a credit card scammer. And then that person would introduce me to somebody else, and that person would introduce me to somebody else, and eventually we would find a place where human beings were bought and sold. And at that point, I would also be at the end of a very attenuated, very long stretched line, and was realizing that my safety was very much in the hands of the people that I trusted until that point.
I was going to ask how dangerous this was. I mean, I'm assuming if they had figured out you were not for real, you would have been killed.
This was an instance where I think you're probably right. And I was wearing a wire. I was recording the conversation secretly. And we went to a broken-down mansion where a Roma family, the Roma are perhaps the most marginalized people in Eastern Europe. The vast majority of them are law-abiding, if desperately poor. There are a few that form hardcore center of criminal mafias that have been the focus of Interpol and Romanian police efforts. This was one of these guys. His shirt was open. He had a dragon emblazoned on his chest. The first thing I said to him was, "I want to buy a girl." And he said, "Come back." So we go into this building and we're told, "Wait here." And we hear a scream above us. And a woman comes down and she's talking very quickly and she says, she doesn't want to come. She's afraid you're going to hit her. Before I have a chance to respond, the woman goes back upstairs. We follow. We're standing in a hallway. Off to our right is a darkened room. Out of that room comes a third woman clutching a young woman with Down syndrome. And on one of her arms is no less than 15 or 16 angry red slashes, as if she's been trying to kill herself. And they, what got to me more than anything was they put makeup on her, and they applied it so hastily in an attempt to make her beautiful that from her eyes, she was crying. The mascara had run down her face, and the lipstick was spread beyond her lips. And I thought to myself, well, okay, I've got to stay in character here because this is somewhat of a dangerous situation. And I thought, well, what would my character do? Would I be happy to see this person? And so I tried to smile. And it is a terribly difficult thing to smile at a situation like that, and I couldn't do it. And at this point, I said, okay, let's go. Let's get away from here. So we went downstairs, and I went back to the original fellow with the pimp with the dragon on his chest and said, "How much for her?" And he said, 2,000-3,000 euros. And I said, "Well, that's too much. How about a trade? How about a motorcycle?" And he said, "Not a motorcycle, a car maybe, a used car." And I said, a dacha, a local make of car. I'd estimated that I could get that for about 1,500 euros or about $2,000 at the right chop shop. And he said, okay. And that was how much that girl cost.
And then the deal was you would have her forever.
What he said initially was, you can have her for 2 or 3 months, but I want a deposit in case you decide to keep her longer. Again, it's another way of saying you're buying this
girl.
You're
buying her. I can't imagine how you felt walking away. I mean, you couldn't buy her, but you had to leave her there.
And this was the terrible part of this book. My models for this early on were Samantha Power and Philip Gorovitch, who wrote absolutely stunningly beautiful books on genocide. But in those books, the people that they were writing about, in many instances, were dead. In this case, I'm writing about people that are very much still alive. And the point of writing this book was to take that discovery on my part and say to the readers, okay, this is now you. This is now on you. This is your job. I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that those people are free. And as I say in here, I very much intend to go back to these places and look for these people. But all of us can do something. All of us.
Benjamin Skinner, talking with Anne Strainchamps about his new book, A Crime So Monstrous. You can find more information, including a list of modern abolitionist groups, on our website at ttbook.org. Later this hour, a conversation with Nobel Peace Prize recipient Muhammad Yunus about ways to eradicate global poverty, one of the roots of modern slavery. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Journalist Adam Hochschild says Benjamin Skinner reminds him of the British abolitionist of 200 years ago, Zachary Macaulay, who once traveled on a slave ship across the Atlantic, taking notes. Hochschild is the author of a history of the heroes of the British anti-slavery movement called Bury the Chains. He told Steve Paulson there are lessons to be learned and hope to be found in the story of the movement created by the very first abolitionists.
It was the first time that a large number of people in one country became outraged and stayed outraged for many years over the plight of people of another color in another part of the world.
Well, and partly what makes the story so remarkable is that slavery was just commonplace. I mean, I'm guessing that back in the 18th century in England, no one would have guessed that it could ever be abolished. It was part of the fabric of daily life.
I know. I mean, ending slavery in the British Empire was as improbable a place for an anti-slavery movement to take birth as it would be today for a renewable energy movement to be born in Saudi Arabia. There were simply too many people making too much money off this trade. Britain dominated the Atlantic slave trade. Roughly half the slaves that crossed the Atlantic, traveling not just to British colonies but to the American South, to other people's colonies, traveled in British ships, 40,000 slaves a year. So there was a whole shipping industry that felt it had a deeply vested interest in this trade.
Well, tell me the story. When this started out, my impression was there were a few activists who got together. I mean, they all hated slavery. And they set out to do something about it. They set out to abolish slavery. How did that happen?
Well, in 1785, the head of Cambridge University made the morality of slavery the topic of the annual Cambridge University Latin Essay Contest. Winning one of these Latin contests at Oxford or Cambridge was a huge thing. People remembered it for the rest of your life. One of the people who entered his contest was a 25-year-old divinity student named Thomas Clarkson, who had no interest in slavery. He just wanted to win this big Latin prize. So he entered the contest. He was a very diligent researcher. He read everything he could find about slavery, interviewed people. Clarkson was absolutely bowled over with horror by what he learned about slavery. Wrote his essay, won the prize, got on his horse and headed for London to make his way in the world. Halfway to London, he found himself thinking not about the pleasure of having won this Latin prize, not about the promising career that awaited him, but about slavery. Got off his horse, sat down by the side of the road, and writes about this very movingly, about how he sat there thinking, and finally the thought came into his mind that someone should do something about this. He got back on his horse and spent the remaining 61 years of his life totally devoted to the cause of ending slavery, first in the British Empire and then in the rest of the world.
Mm. You make the case that he was, for all practical purposes, one of the first great investigative reporters.
In the summer of 1787, Thomas Clarkson went on the road by horseback for about 5 months, making an organizing and investigative trip. He went first, for example, took him 3 days by horseback from London to the port of Bristol, which was one of the major British slave ports. And he wanted to see how sailors were dragooned onto these slave ships, where life, by the way, was horrible for sailors. So what he did was he hung out in the waterfront pubs in Bristol and watched how sailors were dragooned into these jobs. The pub keepers explained how, you know, they would let the sailors run up debts and so forth at the pubs, and they'd get deep in debt, be threatened with prison, and then, well, the only way out would be if you sign on with my friend Captain so-and-so, who's about to set off on a slaving voyage in Africa, then I'll cancel your debts. Mm. So he wrote down things like that. He was a natural investigative reporter. He moved on to the port of Liverpool, where, incidentally, a group of slave ship captains, seeing what he was up to, tried to kill him. In Liverpool, he walked past the window of a ship chandler's shop, a shop that sold supplies to these slave ships, saw some items in the window, handcuffs, leg shackles, thumb screws, an instrument of torture, and another peculiar-looking iron instrument. He didn't know what it was. He asked the shopkeeper, and the shopkeeper said, oh, that's for when your slaves on shipboard are trying to commit suicide by not eating. This is what you use to pry their mouths open.
Oh, my God.
And he said, give me one of each. He put them in his saddlebags, and then from then on, as he traveled around the country, whenever he would arrive in a new town, he would go to the local newspaper, take these things out, put them on the editor's desk, and say, look what our British sailors are doing.
Part of what makes this story interesting is the anti-slavery movement really enlisted all kinds of methods to get the word out, to try to convert people. I mean, getting stories in newspapers, designing political posters, organizing consumer boycotts. I mean, really, the strategies that activists today use.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been involved in activist causes during my lifetime, and I'm sure many of your listeners have. Every major tool that we use was invented, it seems to me, during about this five-year period from 1787, when this movement began, to 5 years later, 1792. The first logo ever specifically designed for a political cause, a kneeling slave in chains surrounded by the legend, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And this was reproduced on hat pins and coat buttons and cufflinks and as lapel buttons. It was the ancestor of the buttons that we wear for a political cause today. And they invented other tools we use, like the consumer boycott. In 1792, more than 300,000 people in England were refusing to eat sugar, the principal product grown by slaves. Another thing that they did, which we take completely for granted today, but it hadn't been done before, is they surveyed members of Parliament. Where do you stand on the issue of slavery? And then they publicized the results. It was a technique that was first invented by these guys 200 years ago.
Are there still lessons to be learned from what these people did 200 years ago?
I think the story of a successful social movement like this ought to provide enormous encouragement for people who are working for progressive social change of various sorts today, because we live in a world where we are faced with the problem of how do you make the empathy of people in a country like this one extend to people elsewhere? How do you make Americans care about people who are dying in Darfur? How do you make Americans care about people who are being tortured by our own troops in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere? And I think we can learn a lot from people 200 years ago who made folks in their country, Great Britain, extend their empathy to a group of people who hadn't been included in it before, the slaves.
Adam Hochschild talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Bury the Chains. What does it take for white people to make the leap of imagination required to reach out and do something about slave trading, either in the present or in the past? Katrina Brown was a seminary student when she received a letter from her grandmother that rocked her world. It was a letter filled with old family history, including a brief mention of her family's past as slave traders in Bristol, Rhode Island.
It was a shock to read on first the level of thinking I was discovering it for the first time, and then second, realizing that actually I already knew and had completely repressed it. And it was just the most you know, it was just a very surreal experience of being horrified and then being horrified to realize that I had buried something that was too inconvenient to deal with.
As Brown grappled with her family's legacy, she invited other members of her family to join her. And she decided to film their journey of investigation. Her documentary, Traces of the Trade, premiered at the Sundance Festival this spring and is touring nationally. It's the story of one family's attempt to come to terms with their slave trading legacy. As it turned out, the family in question, the DeWolfs, weren't just any slave traders. They were the biggest slave traders of them all.
Statistically speaking, basically the largest slave trading family in U.S. history, and that was by virtue of having been involved for three generations, and over the generations accumulated more and more aspects of, basically they had vertical integration. So they had started out as sailors and then became ship captains and then bought the ships, and then from that expanded into owning a bank and an insurance company to provide the financial backing, and then they bought plantations in Cuba, so sugar and coffee plantations. The sugar from the sugar plantations was used, or the molasses rather, to make rum. They bought a rum distillery, created a rum distillery in Bristol, Rhode Island.
Part of the thing that I think is so shocking for many people seeing this is that it does not take place within the contours of the story we've been told all these years. This is not the Deep South. This is, as you call it, the Deep North. This is Bristol,
right.
Rhode Island.
Right.
And the biggest slave trading family in the history is not from North Carolina or from Virginia, but from New England.
Right. And I also assumed early on that they must have been the exception. Our culture has such a deep, deep story about the North being the good guys and the South being the bad guys. And indeed, it was basically, they were extreme. The DeWolfs were, you know, more successful, which is a hard word to say, but than others. But they basically were the tip of the iceberg of this much larger northern involvement. So it was eye-opening just at every turn.
You had a town of people who were invested in this trade.
Shares. Yes.
Who's not involved? I mean, was there anyone around that was not involved in some way, either by directly or indirectly through the purchases they made, through the investments they made?
I think, in general, the whole town was supporting what was going on here.
The slave trade, you got to remember, is not just a few people taking a boat and sending it out. Everyone in town lived off slavery. The boat makers, the iron workers who make the shackles, the coopers who made the barrels to hold the rum.
All of the North was involved. All these cities and towns along the coast, Salem, Boston, Providence, New London, New Haven, New York.
I have had, as you can imagine, reason to talk to many white Southerners who often come up to me after, you know, we've had lots of rough cut screenings and whatnot. And white Southerners have come up to me sometimes in tears, thanking me for telling the story because they feel like they've been shouldering this label of racist
on their
since
own.
The Civil War on their own. And these are the people would be saying, you know, I'm not trying to say we don't have issues down here. We do. But you have lots to be looking at. Please
yeah.
join us.
Do you feel that you, as a descendant of the DeWolf family, do you feel that you personally have a deeper connection to the slave trade? Did your family's money come from slavery?
No one in the group of us, you know, there are 10 of us who traveled to retrace the Triangle Trade. And we, like, I think, pretty much the, you know, vast majority of DeWolf descendants, of which there are, you know, hundreds, probably thousands at this point, the money was, you know, spent, dissipated long ago. But what is definitely clear is the extent to which once you are in the elite, that sort of through the generations, one kind of stays there. So people marry into other families with money or have the education that allows them, us, to make choices in life. So there's definitely this very strong awareness amongst all of us who are working on this and part of the film of the many privileges that we inherited, even if it wasn't direct money from the slave trade.
So these members of your family, many of whom you didn't know before this, decided
right.
to join you in doing this. And they came from different parts of the country, I gather.
Right, from all over. And some were close, you know, two brothers and two sisters and a father and a son. Others didn't know anybody, had never met anyone in the group and were taking a risk to dive in.
Well, after this difficult stay in New England, discovering things that in some ways you wished you hadn't, but that you were, after all, looking for, you then, all of you, went off to Ghana to see the slave forts, but also,
the startling visual evidence is that you went to Ghana and became the minority.
Right.
That must have brought this home in ways that being in New England just can't.
Right. That was operating on a couple levels. One was that we were there during a festival called PANAFEST, which is Pan-African festival that invites people of African descent back from throughout the diaspora for a homecoming pilgrimage, basically. So we were on a pilgrimage, and so were many African Americans and people from the Caribbean. And so that was an extremely intense time to be interacting with people there.
When you start our tour, you'll find that on top of the dungeon, there is a church. One of the first things that would be done to you when you are captured was to be baptized. You lose your name and take a Christian name. You become a slave in the name of God.
Well, we pray that the Spirit of Almighty God and the Spirit of our ancestors accept this humble token and symbolism of our paying tribute to them and never letting their memory nor their legacy die. May they live forever.
When my cousin Dane approached a woman at one of the slave forts to greet her and invite her to one of the dialogues that we were having, she basically said she was hoping not to see any white people here and did not want to shake his hand. And that was very sobering moment for my cousin and for the rest of us hearing about it. At the other end of the spectrum, there were people who were very moved by our being there and for whom there was healing in our presence. So it really ranged to extremes. And we were very self-conscious. We were definitely very, very self-conscious and made some deliberate choices about where it felt okay to go and not go.
Did your ancestors bought our people, our ancestors, with a lot of money?
In the olden days.
Did they buy them with a lot of money? No.
Are you not ashamed of coming here?
What? Am I not ashamed? Yeah, I am ashamed. Yeah. It's a shame. It is a shaming thing.
Was this journey an attempt to make amends? I know you talked about this with your relatives as you went along, and that's part of the discussion that is seen on film. Do you feel as though all of you, were able to come to any conclusions about this? Do you feel as though you made some amends? Did you talk about reparations, for instance?
We did. We talked about every angle on it all. There's only so much you can put in a 90-minute film, but there's this way in which, I guess I'll speak for myself here, to the extent that the government and white America didn't apologize, has never apologized in terms of the government, and didn't make up for the wrong. The wrong was so massive. The harm was so massive, and we never made up for it. So just because those of us today aren't the ones who perpetrated the crime doesn't mean that there isn't still a gap to be filled or a wrong to be righted. So I can sort of step forward into that and say, you know, it's not about me and what I've done wrong, but I can notice how I've been advantaged by this society and say, what can we do? And I know to a lot of African Americans, this even just an acknowledgement, I think a lot of people deeply appreciate truth-telling and an acknowledgement of what happened and appreciate seeing white people go through a process of trying to empathize and trying to get it, which is what we've tried to do.
Talking about history, I feel the heaviness of pulling generations between slave trade business and now. And it just feels like a heavy load of repression. What kind of crazy partnership do we have to silence?
Katrina Brown produced and directed the documentary Traces of the Trade. There's also a book with the same title, written by her cousin, Tom DeWolfe. For more information about either, or to comment on what you've heard, visit our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Many experts on modern slavery agree that it's a problem that won't be fully solved until we eradicate the root cause of slavery, poverty. One of the world's great visionaries on this subject is Muhammad Yunus, the revolutionary economist who created the microcredit movement and founded India's Grameen Bank, for which he won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize. Grameen pioneered microlending, the practice of providing poor people with very small loans which they can use to start businesses and lift their families out of poverty. Over the past 30 years, microlending has spread to every continent and benefited over 100 million families. Now, Muhammad Yunus is talking about going beyond microcredit to what he calls social business. And he told Steve Paulson Grameen Bank has begun a new lending program focused on the very poorest of the poor.
We focused on beggars recently, about 4 years back, because many people were telling us that microcredit is a good idea, but it only works for entrepreneurial poor. And I always said that all human beings are entrepreneurs by very definition of a human being. A human being is an entrepreneurial being. That's how we survived on this planet and flourished on this planet. To demonstrate that people have entrepreneurial ability, 4 years back we introduced a program focused on the beggars. What we do, we go and talk to the beggars, and after we discussion, we said, as you go from house to house begging, would you care to carry some merchandise with you, some cookies, some candies, some toys for the kids, and so on? And if it works, fine, you give people option, whether they will lend, give you some charity money or charity food, or they will buy something from you. And people like that. And now we have over 100,000 beggars in that program. About 10,000 of them have already stopped begging because they became successful door-to-door salesperson.
And these beggars then, I mean, once they take your money, I mean, your loans, do they actually repay them?
Yes. The deal is this is an interest-free loan and there is no time limit. And since there's no time limit, there's no defaulter in that system.
So this is obviously a very different model of banking than
yes,
what
indeed.
Most people have. I mean, you know, the idea that there's no time limit to repay the loan. I guess it raises the question of how do you determine success when you are giving loans? I mean, how do you determine whether your loans are actually helping families get out of poverty?
Well, we follow them up. How many are still continuing begging and how many are not doing that and switch to something else? Now, out of 100,000, over 10,000 have already stopped begging completely. So this is one indication that is working for them. Another is how many times they are borrowing, because the deal is if you can pay back your first loan, you are ready to take the next loan, and a bigger loan, whatever you want. The loan size is about $15. That's about it. Grameen Bank could have given them $15 as a kind of charity to all of them. But probably that would not have changed anything for them because that has not created a process, a system by which they can continue.
Can you explain how your staff members work at Grameen Bank? I mean, what the incentive system is there and how you determine success?
Well, we have 27,000 staff. Each staff is working with their own branch. There are something like 2,500 branches all over the country.
This is all over Bangladesh?
All over Bangladesh. And they serve 7.5 million borrowers. So our staff have to meet all these 7.5 million borrowers within 1 week to do business at their doorstep. So our job, our staff's job is to go and meet them physically at their doorstep to do the business of Grameen Bank. And our system is a weekly repayment system. So every week they are paying a small installment and staff has to go and collect it and discuss about the next loan, when anybody is taking the next loan, how much and what should they do with the money and so on. So these are all doorstep kind of banking than an office-based banking. The success is we have something called five-star system. So we evaluate our performance on the basis of 5 stars. If a branch has 100% repayment rate, the branch gets a star, say about blue star. If the branch makes a profit, then it gets another star, it's a green star. If the branch runs its unit with its own money and creates a surplus, it takes deposits and lends money to the poor people, it doesn't take money from the head office, it doesn't borrow from another branch, then it gets another star, it's a self-sufficient branch. If all the children of Grameen families in that branch are in school then the branch gets another star. And if all the borrowers, usually 4,500 borrowers in each branch typically, if all the families are out of poverty, then branch gets another star. So as many of these five stars you can collect, better you are. So gradually you want to achieve all the five stars.
Now, one thing I don't understand about your banking system, Grameen Bank, is how you have such a high rate of repayment of the loans that you give out. I mean, I've heard it's something like 98%, which is just phenomenal. Yeah, I mean, how do you manage to collect all those loans?
Well, I would say, first of all, our banking system is different than the conventional banking system. We don't have any collateral. We don't have any guarantee from a third party or anybody. We don't have any lawyers in our system. So it's a trust-based banking. So only thing we try to do is to build the banking as a human relationship. So we go to every single person in the bank and meet them very frequently every week. We know them. We know their children. We know their day-to-day activities. People see that it is to their advantage to pay back.
Now, you've written a new book called Creating a World Without Poverty, in which you talk about social businesses. Can you explain what you mean by this?
We have only one kind of business in the whole world that we know. That's how the capitalist system designed in the theory. Business to make money. Profit maximization is the goal of business. That presents the human being in that theory as a money-making machine. It does nothing else but making money. And all he enjoys is making more and more money. As a real human being is not like that. Real human being enjoys making money, but he enjoys many other things. Caring for people, sharing the life with other people, and also make a difference in the world. Those elements are not included in the business world that we have today. Profit-maximizing business is all about me. Everything has to be for me. I ignore everything else. That's a typical profit-maximizing business. But social business is everything for others, nothing for me.
So give me an example of a social business.
We have created some social business in Bangladesh. One example which becomes more known is the one that we have done with the famous multinational company Danone in France.
They're the ones who make Danone yogurt in the United
States. Danone yogurt, exactly. That's the company. We made a company called Grameen Danone, which makes yogurt in Bangladesh, but for a social purpose. The purpose of the company is to bring down the malnutrition among the malnourished children in Bangladesh. There's millions of malnourished children in Bangladesh. And we put the ingredients like vitamin, iron, zinc, and all that into the yogurt, make it a fortified yogurt, and sell it to the children at a very cheap price so that they can afford it. And the company has decided that investors will not take any profit out of it. Profit will stay with the company, and it will expand and enlarge and improve the company with the profit.
Now, it seems for that kind of model to work, you need investors who are at heart philanthropists. I mean, they're not out to make a lot of money in return for their investment. You also need a very warm-hearted multinational company like Danone who's willing to set up these kinds of plants in this business in Bangladesh, presumably without that much financial return.
No financial return at all.
So why do they do it then?
For a social goal, because they feel that this is something that we want, their shareholders would like them to do, so that's why they do it. You use the word philanthropic. The philanthropy is something where you give away money, which we are familiar with. We have foundations, we have charitable organizations. In charity, you can use the dollar only once. Then it's used up and you can't do it again. To repeat the same thing, you have to bring fresh dollar to do that. In social business, your dollar keeps on working because it's a business. Since it doesn't lose money, it's a non-loss entity as a business. It recycles money again and again, and every turn you achieve same social goal. So you can add on social goal one after another, and it is created as an institution, not as a program that you did it and it's over. So that way, social business has much more power than the charity money. And also, business people who made money don't think that need any more money to be made. They feel that they made so much money, but nobody really admired them for their making money because they did it for themselves. Nobody really think they will ever remember what they have done in this world. So everybody has a kind of craving that they want to be remembered when they're gone. Everybody wants to leave their signatures on this planet. I think many young people would decide to go for creating social businesses because it makes sense to them. It's something that they feel that this is the role that they can play. In profit-maximizing companies, in money-making companies, you make money. Then what? What is it that you make money for? You don't feel fulfilled. You don't think you have achieved something in your lifetime. This is one thing that everybody wants to feel. I have achieved something. I have done something with my life. And what do you show at the end of the day? What did you do in this planet? Where did you put your signature on this planet? And that young people understand that, yes, I would like to leave a signature behind. And this is the best way to achieve it, because I can do it, I can make it, I can make it happen.
Muhammad Yunus won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize. His most recent book is called Creating a World Without Poverty. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you would like to purchase a copy of this hour, please call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for The New Abolitionists, number 330A. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Anne Strangechamps, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Mike Ewing, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. We always like to know what you think of our programs. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We look forward to hearing from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.